The United States strikes back at Iran-backed groups in Iraq and Yemen.
On Wednesday, the U.S. launched airstrikes in Iraq, targeting Khatib Hezbollah, which is one of the main Iranian-backed militias.
Plus, did Ukraine accidentally shoot down a plane full of its own prisoners of war?
Russian officials say the plane was carrying Ukrainian prisoners of war to a prisoner exchange, while Ukrainian media, citing sources in the general staff, claimed that the plane was carrying missiles for the S-300 air defense system.
And later, we meet an anti-tank brigade in Ukraine, and we see how the Chinese are trying to quell a rebellion in northern Myanmar. What's in it for them? Today is Wednesday, January 24th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The U.S. military says it struck three facilities Tuesday night in western Iraq used by the Iranian-backed militant group Khatib Hezbollah. The U.S. also carried out another strike against the Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen late Tuesday. It's the latest U.S. move after various militant groups have hit U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria more than 150 times since mid-October. And there have been growing concerns that the U.S. may soon be entangled in another war in the Middle East. I'm joined by VOA's Jeff Seldon for more.
In the early morning hours, Iraq time and Yemen time, on Wednesday, the U.S. launched airstrikes in Iraq targeting Khatib Hezbollah, which is one of the main Iranian-backed militias that operates in Iraq and in Syria. Khatib Hezbollah, in this case, has been blamed for the missile barrage, the rocket and missile barrage that hit the Al Asad air base in Iraq this past Saturday, where four U.S. troops now are said to have suffered some concussions, traumatic brain injuries, and there was some minor damage to the base. But the U.S. responding to those strikes by taking out these, what they described as rocket and missile and one-way attack capabilities that belong to Khatib Hezbollah, some storage areas, headquarters, and training locations in three locations across western Iraq. And then a couple of hours later, the U.S. Launched other strikes, additional strikes against the Houthis in Yemen, taking out what they said were two anti-ship ballistic missiles that had been loaded and were readied to launch at ships in the Red Sea.
In the past, U.S. officials, including the Secretary of State, have said they don't want to expand the conflict. They don't want a regional war. How do last night's actions square with that posture?
Well, in response to the initial strikes in Iraq against Khatib Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed militia, the U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin put out a statement emphasizing that the U.S. does not, in his words, "We do not seek to escalate conflict in the region." But he also said in the statement that the U.S. is fully prepared to take further measures to protect its troops, its people, and its facilities. And he urged Iran, as many administration officials in the U.S. have done, to contact these proxy groups and to cease their attacks. In terms of the missile strikes against the Houthis, there have been a series of strikes, more about 10 so far, over the past 2 weeks. Two of them, notably, have been proactive strikes where the U.S., along with Britain, supported by a coalition of other countries, took out storage areas, missile launchers, and other capabilities that Hezbollah has been using to launch the attacks against merchant ships and U.S. and other Navy ships in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. Those strikes, most recently, though, early morning Yemen time, were preemptive self-defense strikes, strikes that the U.S. took unilaterally because they saw that the Houthis were preparing to launch new attacks on ships. And during a press briefing on Tuesday, the Pentagon press secretary, Major General Pat Ryder, said, "Look, it's quite simple from the U.S. point of view when it comes to the Houthis in Yemen. If the Houthis don't want to get attacked by the U.S., they don't want to have the preemptive strikes taking out their missile locations, the simple thing to do is to stop attacking shipping in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden."
Now, Jeff, the U.S. has attacked these Iranian-backed groups in Iraq, in Yemen, but the attacks from these groups keep coming. Are the American strikes not strong enough? Is the diplomatic pressure not strong enough? Why isn't this stopping?
Well, the reason the attacks are continuing, well, it depends who you talk to, right? Some analysts are saying that clearly that the U.S. needs to take more aggressive actions. There have been some suggestions by analysts and experts, but perhaps at this point, the U.S. would be justified and would benefit from striking some Iranian targets, the Iranian IRGC Quds Force, which is the force in Iran that controls and is thought to pull the strings for many of its proxy groups, that perhaps hitting some targets in Iran itself would send a stronger message to Iran, and that Iran is going to continue encouraging its proxies to carry out these attacks until something stronger, something more meaningful happens that changes their calculus in terms of what they want to do. There are others who say that the U.S. has to be careful, because if it goes too strong, then it will get exactly what it doesn't want, which is a much wider, much broader, much more violent regional escalation. As for the Pentagon, their line has been that they don't seek escalation. They are not seeking a wider war, but that they will continue to hit consistently Iranian proxies, Iranian-backed groups, when necessary, to protect their forces, to protect their interests, and to protect their allies in international shipping.
Jeff Seldon is VOA's national security correspondent. Jeff, thanks for your update on this.
My pleasure.
Following up on one of Tuesday's Flashpoint stories, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken continues his trip in West Africa. His visit to the continent comes amid concerns about stability in the Sahel subregion of West Africa. This follows several coups in Mali, Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Niger since 2020. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Nigerian President Bola Tinubu on Tuesday and praised his leadership, but said it is no secret that there are challenges that need to be overcome to unlock the full potential of Africa's largest democracy.
Tackling corruption, making it easier for foreign companies to repatriate capital, these will all pull in a transformative direction and pull in transformative investment. I know that President Tinubu is focused on these challenges, and we also welcome his very bold economic reforms to unify the currency and fuel subsidies.
Blinken said he had discussed the July coup by a military junta in neighboring Niger.
We also discussed challenges to democracy and security in West Africa. We very much appreciate Nigeria's leadership in ECOWAS to try to move to a return to the constitutional order and democracy in Niger after it's been disrupted.
Blinken traveled to Nigeria from the Ivory Coast, where he met with Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara and discussed regional security challenges.
We appreciate particularly the leadership shown by Cote d'Ivoire in countering extremism and violence.
Blinken said this is his third trip to Nigeria as the top U.S. diplomat, including a virtual visit during the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. One expert told VOA, the Biden administration's diplomatic commitment to Africa is remarkable. Terry McCulley is a visiting senior advisor at the United States Institute of Peace and former U.S. ambassador to the Ivory Coast. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
You know, I've been working in and on Africa since 1985, and I've really never seen so much attention by the U.S. government to the continent, which I think is a great, great sign of U.S. engagement.
On Monday, Blinken launched the trip with a stopover in Cape Verde, a longstanding partner of the United States. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
A Russian military plane crashed in southwestern Russia on Wednesday. Russian authorities say that Ukrainians shot down a plane carrying 65 of their own POWs. That's Alexander Gerasimenko. He lives in the area. He tells a reporter he heard a dull bang sound, and when he first saw the plane, it was already on fire. Then a red flash and a much louder explosion. Anna Chernikova has more from Kyiv.
In the afternoon of January 24th, a Russia Il-76 military plane crashed in the Belgorod region of the Russian Federation. Russian officials say the plane was carrying Ukrainian prisoners of war to a prisoner exchange, while Ukrainian media citing sources in the general staff claimed that the plane was carrying missiles for the S-300 air defense system. The Ministry of Defense of Russia confirmed the crash. According to Andriy Kartopolov, the chairman of the Russian Parliament's Defense Committee, there were allegedly 65 Ukrainian prisoners of war on board who were being transported for a previously arranged prisoner swap, and that it was shot down by three Patriot or Iris-T missiles by the Ukrainian armed forces. Dmytro Lubinets, Ukrainian Parliament Commissioner for Human Rights, said that he is investigating the details of the event and analyzing the information received on the crash of the Russian plane. He urged media representatives and citizens of Ukraine not to draw premature conclusions and to trust official sources only. Andriy Yusov, the representative of the Ukrainian intelligence service, confirmed that an exchange of prisoners between Russia and Ukraine was being prepared for today, but currently the exchange is not taking place. At the same time, he added that the information of the Ministry of Defense of Russia about the alleged transportation of the Ukrainian prisoners of war by Il-76 plane is being checked and clarified. VOA will follow the developments and report updates as they appear. Meanwhile, the shelling of the city of Kharkiv was taking place all day long on January 23rd. Russian forces conducted three strikes on the city, causing at least 9 people injured, including a 4-year-old child. Earlier this week, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky announced the creation of a plan to allow for multiple citizenships in Ukraine. This would allow ethnic Ukrainians from all over the world except Russia to become Ukrainian citizens, as well as those foreigners who are fighting for Ukraine at the front line to get Ukrainian citizenship. This announcement was perceived very positively within the society, especially considering Ukraine is facing unprecedented demographic challenges because of the war. Zelensky also instructed the authorities to develop an action plan for the preservation of the national identity of Ukrainians in Russia, who live on the lands historically inhabited by them. The reason for this is believed to be the desire to fight Russian propaganda, calling Ukraine a historic Russian land, aiming to prove that Ukraine existed on these territories way before the present-day Russia state. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
On Tuesday, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin addressed the first meeting of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group of 2024. Secretary Austin urged the group to continue its support for Kyiv, and he heaped praise on Ukraine's armed forces for their achievements in fending off Russian aggression thus far. He had to participate in the meeting via video link as he's recovering from cancer treatments.
So I urge this group to dig deep, to provide Ukraine with more life-saving ground-based air defense systems and interceptors. And Ukraine has answered Putin's cruelty with courage and defiance.
Elsewhere in Ukraine, the 80th Separate Galician Air Assault Brigade has been fighting against Russian armored vehicles since the start of the war. Anna Kostachenko talked with some of the veteran fighters.
Before Russia invaded Ukraine, this 39-year-old soldier from the city of Dnipro sang professionally in a band called Mr. Jesus. He was also a woodworker. He volunteered to join Ukraine's armed forces in the summer of 2022 and quickly mastered anti-tank complexes. He preferred not to use his real name and instead go by his military call sign Fishik. He says he doesn't want to die or fight, but he learned fast. He says he had to because there is no other alternative. Unlike Fishik, a 23-year-old soldier who goes by the call sign Cliff, has been in the armed forces since 2021 when he signed on to protect Donbas from Russian-backed separatists. But he was sent to the south of Ukraine, and after the area was liberated, he returned to Donbas as a part of 80 separate Galician Air Assault Brigade. He says his job is simple. When he sees a tank, he destroys it. He also says Russian tanks don't stand a chance against his team. For the 24-year-old soldier who goes by the call sign Peregrine, this is the second year protecting Donbas. On his birthday, he was busy fighting in the village of Klishchiivka. He says on his birthday he was tracking three different Russian targets and hit all of them. Each anti-tank missile unit consists of 2 to 5 soldiers who hit the target from about 5,000 meters. This brigade has been fighting for over 20 months now. Fishik says they fully intend to keep going.
Ми українці, а не росіяни. І Росія не зможе з нас зробити росіян.
He says we are Ukrainians, not Russians, and will never be Russian, no matter how hard Moscow tries. He says Ukrainian language and traditions have survived, and the enemy can never destroy that. Soldiers from the brigade are using Ukrainian anti-tank missile systems such as Kiev and Stugna. Since February 2022, they say they have destroyed over 70 Russian tanks and armored personnel carriers. Anna Kostichenko for VOA News, Donetsk region, Ukraine.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A look at violence in northern Myanmar coming up in a moment, but staying now in the Indo-Pacific, since the United Nations Climate Change Summit, or COP28, concluded in mid-December in Dubai, Pacific Island states have been working to implement a brand new $500 million climate protection fund. VOA's Jessica Stone reports.
Scientists say these are among the most endangered shorelines on the planet. The Pacific Island nations, Niue, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Palau. Together, they are on the front line of the battle against climate change.
As ocean states, we'd say protection of the oceans is an important component because it's the largest carbon sink. Every second breath you take comes from the ocean.
Palau President Surungal Whips Jr. says ocean conservation has long been a way of life for those who live in the Pacific Islands. Palauan Environment Minister Stephen Victor provides this example from the 1990s.
The fishermen and their local chiefs got together and then decided that these were areas that needed rest from fishing to allow them to recover.
We should be proud of our historic achievement.
At last year's United Nations Climate Change Summit, or COP28, Pacific Island nations announced the Blue Pacific Prosperity Initiative and raised $228 million towards a $500 million fund to conserve 30% of the ocean. National Geographic's Pristine Seas program is already helping Palau set up a marine protected area and stands ready to advise other Pacific nations as well, says founder Henrik Sala.
We are there for the long haul to make sure that the protected areas are designed properly, located in the right places, so they can maximize the benefits to marine life, to local people, and to the climate.
Victor says he hopes Pristine Seas research can illuminate Palau's deep ocean resources, where indigenous knowledge isn't as extensive.
That helps us understand why fish, especially beyond the reef, utilize a certain deep areas in the ocean to aggregate.
Sala says walling off critical fishing grounds is a proven way to replenish them within 5 to 10 years. But he says the longer-term objective is to put a dent in global warming.
The plankton in the ocean, these microscopic algae and bacteria that live offshore, they capture a quarter of the CO2 emissions that we produce every year.
And Palau President Whip says it's a goal that represents an investment, not only for the region, but for the world.
And our first goal is to get to $500 million. You know, I'd like to see the fund get up to $2 billion. It's 15 countries.
15 countries desperate to protect their precious resources. Jessica Stone, VOA News.
A ceasefire between rebels in northern Myanmar and the country's military has fallen apart. What does the violence mean for China as they are seeking to expand their sphere of influence in the area? I speak with Injin Ning of VOA's Burmese service for more.
What's going on in northern Myanmar? Who are the rebels? What do they want? What's the situation?
The Three Brotherhood Alliance, comprising the Myanmar National Democratic Alliance Army and the Aragon Army and the National Liberation Army, has been engaged in fighting against the Myanmar military in northern Myanmar for nearly 3 months. Operation 1027, launched on October 27 last year, aims to uproot the military dictatorship by joining forces with the Spring Revolution against the military coup. The conflict has resulted in the Myanmar military losing territory in the northern region. Also, these groups are seeking greater autonomy for their respective region.
Are these rebels aligned with any foreign power, or are they natives of Myanmar simply trying to have more autonomy?
According to the alliance statement, since they started their offenses in October, you know, they said they are fighting for their, you know, autonomy, you know, greater, they are seeking greater autonomy for their respective regions. And also, you know, they are helping the Spring Revolution against the military coup.
And when did China step in to mediate? What did they achieve?
Since last December, China has been stepping in to mediate in the conflict between Myanmar's military and the Three Brotherhood Alliance, because it's very close to its border.
But it seems that China's interest is as much about keeping the peace on their border as it is a commercial interest for them as well, right? There's very successful trade going on there.
According to China Foreign Ministry's spokesperson, Mao Ning, told reporters after the peace talks took place on January 10 to 11 in Kunming, that two sides agreed to implement the ceasefire immediately. She also added that they also pleaded not to harm residents at the Chinese border. So yeah, of course, China is actually putting pressure on the Three Brotherhood Alliance to do business with the military and limit its involvement in border revolutionary activities, according to my interview with the, you know, China-Myanmar experts. Additionally, you know, they indicate that the Myanmar military is useful to China for certain projects, citing the example of the Zhaoqiu deep water port project in western Myanmar. Clearly, you know, China will benefit from a reduction of violence on its border. And also, that's why China has been seen as trying to expand its sphere of influence in that area. So China has a strategic interest in stabilizing the border region to reduce violence, especially in areas like the Kokan region, where cybercrime is prevalent and poses a threat to Chinese citizens.
So the ceasefire didn't last. They're fighting again. Can you tell us how, when, and why did that ceasefire fall apart?
According to witnesses in this region, told VOA that widespread gunfire in northern Shan State less than a day after the, you know, ceasefire's announcement. So the breakdown of the ceasefire was attributed to renewed violence and attacks by the Myanmar junta, as accused by the Three Brotherhood Alliance.
Injin, it seems that China has really two interests in this, in mediating the conflict between the rebels and the military, but also the strategic commercial interests in the region. How are they balancing the two?
China is trying to pressure on both sides. So because of their especially economic interest, and basically they want to have their security in their investment projects, like the Chinese-Myanmar pipeline and other like projects called Zhaoqiu Deepwater Port Project in Rakhine State.
That's Injin Ning of VOA's Burmese service. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.